2004 to 2006, I went through, a really profound, what you might call a dark night of the soul, really deep depression. And that was a very isolating experience. It was kind of a vicious feedback loop in that the worse I felt, the more shame I felt. I felt like, oh, people don't want to spend time with me. I'm a bummer. I'm not fun to be around. And so I just kept isolating myself further, which made me feel worse. And it was just a really tough loop to get out of. Hadn't really thought about harming myself until this one night. And I woke up in the middle of the night in this just deep panic attack and just my whole body shaking. And this voice that had been running in my head telling me life is awful, it'll never get better again. Life is just terrible. It was at a fever pitch and it was kind of screaming at me, and I was kind of huddled and my whole body was shaking. And I just thought, I can't handle a night of this, let alone a whole lifetime. And then thoughts started turning to, okay, well, there's only one way out of this. If I'd had access to something to end my life, I might have.
This episode of the Kintsugi Podcast is brought to you by Pause, Breathe, Reflect, which can help you bring mindfulness to your everyday moments. Hey there, it's Michael, and this is the Kintsugi Podcast. Connection. In today's world, we all thirst for it. We hunger for belonging. We all want to feel heard and seen and loved. We want to feel connected. This is the Kintsugi spirit. In the lives we've lived, we've all had moments of great joy, but also moments where we have cracked, we have broken. And we try to find a way to come together, to celebrate those scars as golden symbols of our strength and resilience. This week's story of connection is with another like-hearted human. He's a husband, a father, an entrepreneur, a cyclist, and a Toronto Blue Jays fan, which gives him high praise in my book. But ultimately, he's a connector. So if you're ready, settle into a comfortable position. Take a healthy breath in. And a slow releasing breath out. And get ready to get to know Mike Bursick. Hey, Mike, how you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm happy to be here chatting with you.
Yeah, too bad our names didn't catch on in popularity.
Yeah.
You know, the name Mike and Michael, it has so much potential to be a very popular name, but somehow it never really caught on, huh?
Yeah, well, we'll keep plugging away.
We'll do our best. So I'm psyched to sit down with you and talk about the work that you do and really this whole concept of connection, which is the spirit of the show. But before we get into all that, I'd like to ask you a few questions so the audience can get to know you a little bit better. I always love starting off with this question. What's one good thing that's happened to you or for you already today before this moment?
Well, we're pretty early in the morning still. I started my morning out with Tuesdays and Thursdays. I go to the gym at 6 a.m. And that's always a great start to the morning. And actually bumped into somebody that I hadn't seen in about 3 or 4 years. And we had a great conversation. So that was a pretty nice way to start the morning.
All right, that's a good one. Yeah, connecting with the body and connecting with a colleague or a friend you haven't seen in a while. It's really remarkable, like as we go into real life this year and we think about going into it more in 2024, how we're seeing people we haven't seen in person in years because of the pandemic and a whole host of other factors probably.
Yeah, it's been nice to kind of re-embrace some of my old routines, and the gym was a big part of the routine. And we live a block and a half away from a local YMCA. And it's taken them a while to kind of get back online. Obviously, you know, there haven't been any COVID restrictions in a while, but when they reopened, it was kind of a little bit of a shell of its former self. And now it's starting to, they're starting to bring a lot more stuff back, which is nice to see, not just for me, but for, we have a family membership. So, you know, the stuff for the kids as well. And so it's such an amazing organization. And what, you know, what we get for $100 a month is crazy.
It really is, isn't it? It is a really cool organization. We've belonged to a couple throughout our tenure as a family, and my parents belonged to their local Y that was only like a half a mile away from their home. And their Y has everything. It has medical care, child care, physical care, mental health care. It has it all. It's pretty wild.
Yeah, it's great.
So you're up in Toronto. So I'm going to give you some space here to be Toronto's best spokesperson. I know you're a big fan of Toronto. So tell us, like, what makes the city of Toronto so amazing?
I'll qualify this by saying from May through October, Toronto is the best city in the world. It drops a few spots on the list from November to April, in my estimation. Winters can be a little bit hard here. But, you know, it's a cliche, and maybe a cliche for people from Toronto. Maybe other people don't know this, but Toronto is always ranked the most diverse city in the world. And we welcome people from all over the world. And it's amazing. You know, from my house, I can walk up to Bloor Street, which is a 5-minute walk. And as I'm walking eastbound from there, I walk through Little Portugal, all these Portuguese shops. And then I go through Little Ethiopia, which is only, you know, a block or two, but a bunch of, you know, Ethiopian restaurants and shops like that. And then I hit Little Korea. And then going east, it kind of becomes a little bit more diverse. But then not too far is Little Jamaica. And it's just people coming from all over the world, and they tend to congregate in certain areas. And you can go to Little Ethiopia and get, like, you know, really authentic, amazing banjera that as good as you would get in Ethiopia, and kimchi in Little Korea. And it's just, and this is, we're talking about a 20-minute walk. I can go through these four different countries, and it's just amazing. And, you know, if you get on the subway or you get on the streetcar here, you will hear 20 different languages around you. And it's just such a diverse basket of people and cultures, and then together co-creating, you know, this global culture in the city. And that's pretty amazing. And then each of these cultures contributes their festivals, their traditions, all this stuff that generally they're quite welcoming to people from outside that culture to come and experience it, right? And so especially in the summer, you know, everything comes alive. There's patios everywhere, there's festivals everywhere. People come out of their hibernation, and yeah, it's just such an incredible energy. And I mean, that's the primary thing, but there's world-class theater, world-class restaurants. You know, it's, I grew up here, and then after university, I left and I lived out in the British Columbia, in the British Columbia Rockies for about 10 years. And then I came back in 2005, I think it was. And in that 10-year span, and I don't know whether this was, you know, the mayor, we had this amazing mayor at the time, or what the factor, it went from kind of this sleepy backwater city, which maybe once in a while would crack the top 20 cities in the world, but was really considered sort of second tier. And now it's up there mentioned with the New Yorks and the Londons and the Parises of the world as one of the top global cities. So I'm pretty happy to call it my home. And I'm also excited to explore what spending part of my winter abroad might look like. I'm Mediterranean. I like warm weather.
Yeah. Well, Toronto is definitely not going to give you warm weather during the winter. So I'm not sure if you know this, but I grew up on the other side of the pond in Rochester.
Okay. Yeah.
The pond being Lake Ontario. And you happen to be speaking right now with America's chief Toronto Blue Jays fan.
Oh,
like,
nice.
I've been a fan since day one. So I'm hugely invested in the city of Toronto. And so as the Blue Jays go, so goes my summer and my mood.
Yeah, it's maybe a little bit too soon, but my heart is still a little bit broken from this season. I was expecting more.
Yes, I can't wait for next year. That's sort of like my mantra. So, like, yeah, next year is our year. We're going to do it next year.
Yeah. Well, try being a Maple Leafs fan.
Yeah, well, yeah. The Maple Leafs are coming around. So, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, baseball was my true first passion. And so, that was my first professional Major League Baseball game. And I had dreamt as a kid to grow up to play shortstop for the Blue Jays. So that was my dream. Yeah, not too many kids from America dream about playing shortstop for our Canadiens baseball team.
Yeah. Well, you share that dream with my son, who is currently very, very motivated. Ever since he was five, he said, I want to be a Toronto Blue Jay. And he's currently playing shortstop, sometimes third base. Yeah. So that's an interesting journey as a parent, how to support something like that.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. You let it breathe. My dad let it breathe for a bit. And then I think he sort of knew that we'd go on to other dreams, which I have. So, but I'm still a fan.
Yeah.
Still a fan. So let's get into who you are. So if you took what you do professionally and placed it off to the side, because we're going to get into that a little bit later, how would you describe, Mike, who you are?
I would say probably one of my biggest traits is curiosity. I've been curious my whole life, just a lifelong learner, and that hasn't stopped. You know, now that I'm 52, I'm still insatiable when it comes to learning. Really, over the last few years, that has extended mostly to myself. And just really curious about myself and what makes me tick and how did I come to be the way I am and what was, you know, who wrote the operating software for my operating system.
Yeah.
And that's been quite a journey, often painful, usually challenging, but always rewarding. And that takes a number of, you know, different modalities and approaches. And it's easy to get a little too into that and get a little bit too earnest about it. And so I try and make sure that, you know, all that journey of self-discovery is balanced with a whole lot of just living life and having fun and enjoying other people's company and enjoying my family and stuff like that. Because I do know I can get prone to being just a little too into that and a little too earnest about it. And I certainly know people who are really, really earnest about that mission. And it's a great mission. But I've come to appreciate being outdoors more and more as I've aged, and particularly quiet time outdoors. And as my kids get older and I hopefully, you know, have more time to myself, I used to love spending time in the wilderness by myself, usually for just like a day or two at a time. But just that's like a really intimate experience with the outdoors and with wilderness, which, you know, it's nice to go camping with friends, or we do canoe trips all the time. And that's beautiful time, but you're not really present with it in the same way as when you're alone, particularly if you don't have any technology or bring any technology with you. You're just forced to be completely present. And that's a really magical thing. And it's actually something that I've incorporated into my events with Wayfinders, where usually at some point towards the end of the event, we take people off into the wilderness and we just kind of scatter them around and give them a place to call their own where they can't see or hear anybody else. And, you know, usually leave them there for a few hours. And it's amazing how profound that experience is for some people. You know, these are typically very driven, busy entrepreneurs who are kind of go, go, go. And just being able to stop and sit in one place for 2 or 3 hours with nothing but stillness around them and, you know, the beat of their own heart and their own thoughts and their own soul. You know, I've had people who've had mystical, you know, religious experiences from that act. And part of it is just the places we take them to are often quite mystical. But I think that really it's just the act of being quiet and still. And so that's one of those things that I really love to do, but and would love to do a lot more of. And, you know, back to the theme of connection, that's the other thing that really makes me tick. It's just spending time connecting with other people and doing it in a manner that's very present and very nurturing and very, I don't know, just deep and profound. Yeah, I love to do that.
Yeah, so, and I also love in what you share, just almost a holistic quality to it. So, you know, you speak of connection, but on the other side of the coin, you know, some solitude and to give you a chance to connect, say, with yourself or with nature. And so, and there's this nice thread between the two of those around curiosity. So getting to know yourself a little bit better and getting to know others better. And how old are your kids right now?
We have a 15-year-old and 2 13-year-olds.
Okay, cool. So I have a couple years on you. So we're getting ready for Empty Nestville, however you might say it.
Yeah.
So those moments of solitude will come to you eventually as the kids get a little bit older. So you'll have a chance to just be out in the canoe by yourself without tech and just soak in nature. So
yeah. And I hope there's also lots of moments in the canoe with my kids as well as they get older.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's a good balance. You know, we get to have vacations or holidays with them. And then there's also a little bit of extra time just to be still and be quiet, which is really cool. So one last question is, you know, we dive in and get to know you better. Is there something that your parents or a parent said to you or maybe did when you were younger that is still with you today and influences how you show up today?
Maybe if I can, I will use one from each parent.
Sure, yeah.
My dad also loved the outdoors, and he used to take me to this provincial park north of about 4 hours north of Toronto called Killarney Provincial Park. Most beautiful park in Ontario. It's these beautiful, clear lakes and beautiful mountains. And so we used to go there every summer for about 2 or 3 weeks. And we would typically car camp rather than, you know, going out in the backcountry. We would just get a campsite in the campground. But then we would almost every day just hop in the canoe, and we'd canoe about 15 minutes down the lake. And there was this kind of granite outcropping that was fairly flat. And we would just hang out there, you know, most of the day. And there's like cliffs to jump off of, and, you know, really nice swimming and just this gorgeous view. And we used to spend hours and hours there. And that really just sort of cemented my love of the outdoors. And maybe I'll tell you a quick story about that. My father passed away when I was 16 after a 2-year battle with cancer. And I think I was about 13 the last time we went to Killarney. And we paddled out to our rock one day, and there were some other people on there. And so we had to go find another spot to spend the day. We paddled back there the next day and got to the site, and there was a bunch of garbage all over. And my father was livid. People were just selling this beautiful place, and he grabbed a rock and he carved it into this granite, "Take your garbage with you." And he got sick soon after that, and we never went back to Killarney. And about 18 years ago, and this was after I'd come back from British Columbia, 2005, and I asked a couple of friends if they would come with me to Killarney. I wanted to do a little pilgrimage back to this place that I hadn't been at for so many years. And we ended up doing this 60 or 70 mile hike, 5-day hiking trip. And at the very end of this trip, we got back to George Lake, which is where this granite rock was, except I had only ever canoed there, and I wanted to go back there. I'd only ever canoed there. I had no idea how you could get there. And so we ended up bushwhacking through the woods for, you know, an hour, and, you know, thorns tearing at us and everything. And miraculously, we found the spot. And I looked down, and there in the rock were those words that my dad had scrawled on there. And that was, it was about 20, 21 years later, something, those words were there. And I ended up doing just, you know, a little ceremony. It was kind of a letting go ceremony of my dad, because I'd never properly grieved him. And it was just such a powerful experience of just remembering him, but also letting go of, you know, the grief and the anger and all that stuff of him leaving me so early. And so we've since taken our kids there every summer, and we go back to that same rock. And it's just this beautiful continuity. And my hope is that they'll bring their kids there. So that's one thing, that's a very long story to answer your question, but just something beautiful I picked up from my dad was just this love of and connection to the outdoors. And from my mom, she, growing up, she was always very concerned about people who had fewer means, who were less fortunate, people who were on the margins of society. And she always took them in and cared for people and did charitable work. And so for me, that's just a reminder of paying it forward and looking after people who maybe don't have access to the same things that I do or that I had growing up. So those are two things that I'm very grateful to my parents for bequeathing to me.
Well, thanks for sharing those, Mike. That was great. I love good stories of any length, especially those from our parents or a parent or a guardian, because we bring a lot of that with us as we get older, and it shapes who we are. So I love what you shared about your dad. Good and bad. So, but that ritual of, you know, coming back to that place, you know, with your kids is really special. So it's that, again, a nice point of connection or a thread linking the generations, which is pretty cool. So let's dive into connection. This is part of your work. And I want to spend some time talking about the work. You've already referenced Wayfinders, but also your work with entrepreneurs today. So when was it when you first like really discovered the importance of connection? Is this something from your younger days, or did it come into existence more for you, more powerfully as an adult? So I figure we can start here, and we'll just see how the conversation unfolds as we talk about connection, because the time that we're living in right now, it feels like we're thirsty for connection, but maybe having some difficulty actually making the connection happen. So love to get your thoughts.
Well, if I were to draw a line back to maybe My life is really, both my personal and professional lives are focused on connection these days. That's sort of the primary focus. And if I were to draw a line back, you know, to its earliest origins, probably in childhood, particularly, you know, later childhood, where I've kind of felt like an outsider a lot of the time and didn't really feel like I belonged or fit in too many places. You know, looking back at that now, I remember that it's feeling like a profound sense of alienation, like I'm not welcome in many places. And now, knowing what I know now and having spent so much time studying it, you know, that is a profound human need. Our brains over, you know, hundreds of thousands of years have evolved to become wired for human connection. And if you were living in, you know, the plains, the savannas of Africa in a tribe and you decided to go it alone, you would probably die. And so we relied on other humans deeply. And all of our neurochemical circuits became wired for that. And our brains haven't really changed that much since those days. Anyway, so that was a profoundly painful experience growing up. And it wasn't until I got to university that I really felt like a sense of belonging somewhere. And then when I moved to British Columbia and finding those places, and I can still access that, even though I live a very connected life, I can still access that feeling and I can empathize with that feeling of being really disconnected, of not having places where you feel like you belong and not having those true, deep, intimate connections. The other touch point is from 2004 to 2006, I went through, a really profound, what you might call a dark night of the soul, really deep depression. And that was a very isolating experience. It was kind of a vicious feedback loop in that the worse I felt, the more shame I felt. I felt like, oh, people don't want to spend time with me. I'm just a, you know, I'm a bummer. I'm not fun to be around. And so I just kept isolating myself further, which made me feel worse. And it was just a really tough loop to get out of. And the turning point was one night, and I'd been having increasingly dark thoughts, hadn't really thought about harming myself until this one night. And I woke up in the middle of the night in this just deep panic attack and just my whole body shaking. And this voice that had been running in my head telling me life is awful. It'll never get better again. Life is just terrible. It was at a fever pitch and it was kind of screaming at me and I was kind of huddled and I was, you know, my whole body was shaking. And I just thought I can't handle a night of this, let alone a whole lifetime. And then thoughts started turning to, okay, well, there's only one way out of this. And I don't know exactly how, but I managed to get back to sleep. That night, it took maybe 2 or 3 hours. I was on the verge, you know, if I'd had access to something to end my life, I might have. But I got to sleep and I woke up the next morning and I said, okay, this has got to stop. And I went to go see my doctor and I'd been kind of, you know, messing around with medication, taking it, stopping it, which is just a terrible way to go. And I said, I'm committed to getting better. You know, tell me the medication, tell me the dosage, I'm going to commit to it. And I knew that was just the starting point. And I ended up really committing to my therapy, to group therapy, to yoga, to meditation, to exercise, to really turn things around. And as I started to get better, I started to, you know, really put more time and attention towards connecting with other people. And then I became very intentional about it in terms of how to build out my social network, the people I wanted to connect with. And so now that's an extremely intentional part of my life. And I have an assistant who helps me with that. And I have all these systems to how I approach that. But it was a long road back from those days.
I appreciate you sharing that, Mike. So I think we all go through dark moments of one degree or another. So as you were sharing your early days of not fitting in, I could relate. I could feel it in my body, just not feeling like I fit in anywhere. You know, you're trying to find, my language would be as a cyclist, I'm trying to find my Peloton, although I didn't have that language back then when I was in middle school or in high school. Growing up, were you a shy kid? Would you describe yourself as shy?
Yeah, I was an only child. I was a child of immigrants. And back then, Toronto wasn't, even though I'm Caucasian, I still felt, you know, Toronto was not nearly as diverse as it is now. And it was, you know, I went to a Catholic school. It's a very white school and mostly, you know, Britain, England, those countries. And so I felt a little bit of an outsider. And, you know, now looking back on it, it seems like such a strange thing, particularly in such a diverse city as Toronto. But yeah, I was shy and I felt I didn't belong in those circles. And now speaking out about this, you know, about human connection and its converse, you know, isolation and disconnection, that I think is the default experience for a lot of people. And it seems a lot of people did not have those places of belonging. maybe they had it in their home, but, and I see this in my kids where there's just this intense desire to be part of a group. And then at the same time, this intense need to fit in. And the problem with fitting in is you're abandoning, you know, your true authentic self in the process to try and fit some ideal of what you think will get you accepted. And so I try to reinforce to my kids, you know, the people are going to be drawn to you and they'll respect you more for just being yourself and being unabashedly yourself. And, you know, the wrong people won't be attracted to that. And that's great. You don't, you know, that's not who you want to appeal to. But the right people are just going to love it that you have that spirit and that desire to just be yourself. So, yeah, finding those places is difficult. And that's my work, is creating those places where people can just show up and be completely unabashedly themselves, all their quirks and idiosyncrasies and all their struggles and challenges, and just be accepted for who they are.
All right, let's take a break. Take a full breath in and a slow releasing breath out. And relax the body as you soak up our conversation. Ah, I hope that felt good. Okay, now that we're a little bit more relaxed, can we be real? I think our morning routines, well, they've gotten a little out of control. You might not have time in the morning to meditate because you're busy doing other things like trying to get to work or getting the kids off to school. And this is where my app, Pause, Breathe, Reflect, comes in, because I built it for busy people with a whole bunch of shorter practices. So if you don't have 10 minutes in the morning to meditate, cool beans. You're human after all. But I bet you have 5 times throughout the day when you have 2 minutes to practice and let go of stress and bring mindfulness to your everyday moments. So today, download Pause, Breathe, Reflect for free and begin to stress less, sleep better, and join a community of like-hearted humans rippling something worth rippling into the world. All right, let's go back to our conversation and celebrate the kintsugi within us all. Yeah, what I hear from that is have faith that you'll find your people, you know, in due time. And there was something I just read actually before we came to sit down together right now. And the saying was, don't be afraid to be a Fruit Loop in a world filled with Cheerios. So, you know, a little cereal metaphor, a little cereal wisdom. So I thought that was cute for people that know both those cereal brands. So within kintsugi, the lacquer that brings the pottery back together is called urishi. So it's that lacquer that when it dries, it's really hard. And when it's mixed with gold, it creates those beautiful golden scar lines. So I'd love to hear from you based on your work, because this is a big part of who you are. So how does one go about forming connection, especially nowadays, you know, whether you happen to be an extrovert or introvert or amnivert or shy or otherwise? So in your study and your experience, how does one go about doing this? I imagine you'd say there's probably not one way, but I'd love to hear from you. And if you could share ways that you've done it that may help other people listening right now.
Yeah. Like you said, there's so many ways about it. And I can share a few of the ways that I've gone about it. One is that over the years, I've joined many different communities. And for me, being an entrepreneur, I've joined a few different entrepreneur communities. And, you know, I really find in those places that I'm connecting with my peers, because entrepreneurs, they're a different bunch, a neurodivergent bunch, if you will. I was just doing some writing the other day about ADHD. And, you know, I was diagnosed with ADHD last year. And as I've been researching this condition, discovering that there's some studies that point to the prevalence of ADHD in the world of entrepreneurship as high as 50%. And, I'm getting a little bit off topic here, but just that entrepreneurs, it's kind of like we get each other, right? When I get in those circles.
Sure thing, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of a different approach to life. And most of the entrepreneurs I know became entrepreneurs because they just couldn't fit in a regular work environment. myself included, after university, I got fired from my first three jobs in the span of, I don't know, 5 months. And then I said, okay, I think I'm getting the hint here. This is not for me.
Time to pick a different path, Mike.
Yeah, exactly. So I've joined a number of communities where I've connected with some amazing people and formed some wonderful friendships. And there's, you know, these days, there's so many different communities and you can connect with people on so many levels, whether it's entrepreneurship or a love of dance or 18th century violins or whatever, you know, whatever you want to connect with. And I've also obviously created my own community through Wayfinders. And, you know, I've created an entire company and a fairly successful company out of that. But I also have done, you know, things where I just host dinners, and I've hosted dinners in my home. And I used to do these taco dinners where I'd invite four or five people, and then I would pick four or five different recipes for, you know, these kind of gourmet tacos. And we'd all sit together. And then for every course, I would, you know, grab somebody from the table. It's like, okay, you're going to help me, you know, make these Baja fish tacos, or, and then the next person. And then I would ask each person in advance, I say, pick one question that you want to ask the table. And so with each course, they would pose a question, usually a pretty thought-provoking question that would lead to some really, you know, insightful or deep conversation. And so I find with all of my gatherings, if you can put a little bit of work into the facilitation part of it, you know, I've had dinners where we have, actually last night, we had a little bit of a reunion for some of the people who went on my Mongolia experience. And there was 10 of us at the table. And we had a wonderful group conversation, all 10 of us, rather than, you know, the typical dinner where it devolves into pairs or maybe threes or something like that. And you're kind of talking about just random, often shallow stuff. When you put a little bit of facilitation in, and these days it's easy. You can go online and, you know, search up like question cards or conversation cards, whatever. They make it easy for you. You just pull out a card and it just invites you to a deeper level. And when you can open people up to taking things a little bit deeper, it usually invites a deeper level of vulnerability, which then invites a deeper level of connection. And my friend Philip McKernan has this saying that relationships move at the speed of vulnerability. And so the more you are willing to be vulnerable, the more you're going to create an opening for other people to be vulnerable. And then I'm sure you felt slightly or maybe much more stronger connection to me when I shared that story about my dad than if, you know, than if we were talking about the weather. So when you can create spaces and places for people to be more vulnerable than they are in their everyday life, it's not only very connecting, but it's also very refreshing because people are tired of just, you know, talking about endless crap.
Amen to that. It's so just transactional. It leaves you wanting, at least it leaves me wanting so much more. It's just like, what are we doing here? It just skims the surface and it almost seems like a whole bunch of people are just moving on to the next thing, which they're probably going to do in a transactional way as well. And so we have this great gift called life that's filled with so much awe, and we're living very transactionally. And what I love, what you've shared so far, is just getting back to your first principle of curiosity. Is it's almost an essence of asking the second question or the third question to pull back the layer of the onion and to get to that vulnerability.
Yeah, exactly. And we all have innate desire to be seen and heard and to be truly seen for who we are. And that goes back to that authenticity piece, right? And so if we can give somebody the gift of just being present with them and listening deeply and being curious about them, it's an incredibly reaffirming experience for the other person to be seen and heard like that. And it's also very rare in this day and age, right? And so that brings it back to that curiosity piece. And so, you know, if I were your relationship coach and you wanted to build more relationships with people, I would say start by being curious. Take a really deep interest in other people. And I'm so insatiably curious about other people. I just find people fascinating. And I especially find people that piss me off fascinating, because, you know, it's easy to like, oh, somebody, you know, person pisses you off and you just want to avoid them, or you just want to judge them or write them off, whatever. I find that people who piss me off reveal to me so much about myself. And so if I can get curious about that and like, what is it about this person that is pissing me off? And what is that telling me about myself? It can become quite interesting. And then there have been people who've like, you know, at first opportunity of like, I've really bristled at them, like, oh, this person really turns me off. And I think it's Abraham Lincoln had this saying, it's like, I do not like this man, I must get to know him. And I don't know whether I'm paraphrasing that or whatever, but now when I encounter people that kind of turn me off, I almost want to get to know them better. And I've discovered that sometimes I become completely enamored with these people that piss me off in the first place. And I think of, you know, there's this one person on my recent Mongolia experience that like really did not vibe with in the first couple of days. And then I thought, I want to stick with this and I want to get curious and I want to spend time with her and get to know her. And by the end, she became one of my favorite people on the experience. And I just, you know, I discovered this whole other side of her and we just had wonderful conversations. So anyway, just bringing it back to curiosity, you know, trying to get over that initial judgment and giving people the gift of deep listening. And the other thing I would say, and this is kind of, you know, in the realm of tactics and execution, is it's very easy to take relationships for granted. And one thing I've discovered, which is fairly self-evident, but sometimes forgotten, is that relationships, you need to invest in them and you need to nurture them. And a lot of people have those relationships, you know, that are 30 years old or 20 years old or whatever, and years can go by and you get back together. It's like no time has passed. That's wonderful. But, you know, why let years pass between connections? You can probably connect with them more frequently. And so I have, you know, I have a list, I have a database of all the people that I want to stay connected with. And then I have a whole system for ensuring not too much time passes. And then, you know, now I've taken it to the next level and my assistant, you know, we've set up a whole framework so that, you know, when so much time has passed, she reaches out to them and said, and then I have, you know, I send them three links. One's a book a lunch with me, one to book a coffee with me, and one's a link to book a call with me, whatever they're comfortable with. And so I'm kind of out of the whole loop. And I know some people are like, oh, high and mighty, you know, you can't even reach out to me to schedule lunch. You got to get your assistant to do it. But I tell them, I want to spend my time, you know, connecting with you and being fully present. And I don't want to, you know, deal with the admin or anything like that. I want to focus on our connection, and people get that. And so that's kind of, you know, the whole sort of ecosystem of how I approach this, whether it's connecting, you know, being part of other groups, whether it's creating my own experiences, and it could be as simple as a dinner in my home, you know, or creating a whole company around it, creating a whole system around connecting with people. But to me, it's the most important thing in my life is those connections. And, you know, all the research shows that it's the number one contributor to your well-being and to your longevity. So I don't want to leave that to chance. And I think too many people approach their relationships as more of a passive thing, just kind of waiting for opportunities to come their way. And I've discovered it works better, for me at least, if I'm very active about that and intentional.
Yeah, what you just mentioned, Mike, the research definitely points to it, whether it's the Harvard study or the work around blue zones, how important community is in health span and lifespan. And us guys, we don't do this whole thing of connection very well. We struggle. So I know a lot of men, once they hang up their cleats, whether they're an entrepreneur or a corporate warrior, they feel lost because they thought they had a whole bunch of connections. And nowadays with social media, you think you have a whole bunch of connections, but many of those connections don't stay with you unless you nurture them. And if you take them for granted, like anything, you will rue the day when you lose it and you want it back. What I love and appreciate about your work is, you know, obviously you're speaking to a group of humans, like-hearted humans that want to connect, that also include men, because I do think us guys need to maybe go back to school or something to learn how to connect with each other better. So we have relationships after we retire, after we don't have to work for money.
Yeah.
If you could share, you mentioned Mongolia a couple times, what you discovered about Mongolia or about yourself or just the whole experience, because my hunch is that many people here in the U.S., maybe in Canada, but I'll just speak for my fellow Americans here, may not even know where Mongolia is. My wife is a childbirth doula. And so years ago, this might be 15 years ago, there was a documentary called Weeping Camel. And it showed the migration of the camels in Mongolia, and one was giving birth. So it was a whole birth-related type of movie, and we watched it without any subtitles. So my whole experience with Mongolia is about this documentary, and I've seen some of the images you've put up on LinkedIn, to name one platform. But I'd love for you to share what you discovered about the country, maybe you discovered about yourself and the people that you were with during that trip, because it sounds absolutely amazing.
We might be here a while. I have so much to say.
Yeah, we'll go for it, you know.
Well, I'll answer the geographical question. So Mongolia is this massive country. It's sandwiched in between Russia to the north and China to the south, Kazakhstan in the west. This event took place in far western Mongolia. We started off about 10 kilometers from the Kazakh border. And the people in that area are all ethnic Kazakhs, and they're all nomads. So they tend these gigantic herds, you know, typically 1,000 animals or more, and they move with their animals. And so in the summer, they go up to, you know, high ground, and their animals will graze there for a while. And then the fall, they'll move. This particular family we were with, they have a fall and spring home, and then they have a winter home, which is farther down because it's a very cold region. And in a nutshell, you know, what I do is I take groups of entrepreneurs, typically 20 to 25 people, and I take them to these, you know, remote, spectacular places around the world. And it's equal part adventure and community building and personal growth sort of retreat, or more accurately, personal awareness. I take people through a facilitated journey of hopefully developing some self-awareness. And the reason I take people to these far-flung locations that are usually quite remote is that I found that the farther I take people from their typical day-to-day environment, and the more unfamiliar it is and the harder it is to get to, the more of an environment it creates for that journey of self-awareness. Because, you know, they've been stripped away of all the usual, you know, their office, their titles, their usual accoutrement, and they're left with an environment that is very ripe for discovery. And so with this event was very different than anything I'd ever done. You know, often some of the places I've done, you know, we stay at like a 4-star lodge, and it might be remote in the middle of nowhere, but it's a beautiful lodge. This was very different. We were in an area, vast, vast area that was extremely sparsely populated with zero infrastructure. So what we did was we met up with a local nomad family, and we accompanied their annual fall migration to their winter grounds. And so we met them at their fall camp, and we spent 3 days with them there, just kind of learning a little bit about nomad life and helping them with, you know, the animals and riding horses and all that kind of stuff. And then over the course of 3 days, we did about 100 kilometer, 60 mile migration down to their winter grounds. And there's, I think, about 1,000 sheep, 100 yaks, 50 horses, 3 camels, and this family and us. And so on those 3 days, we split the group up into 3. And on any given day, you were either walking to the next camp, or you were in a group that was taking down camp and setting up the next camp, or you were on horses and you were herding the animals. And our camp, you know, we had these traditional gurs or yurts, which is where we would eat and meet. And then we also had some tents in which we slept. And Mongolia is the most sparsely populated country on Earth. And the Western Mongolia is the most sparsely populated region of this very sparsely populated country. There's in this area of like, you know, 10,000, 50,000 square kilometers. I don't know what it is. Vast. There's maybe a few hundred families living there. And you have these tall mountains, but you have these vast, incredibly wide open valleys where you can see forever. And there's no signs of civilization. And just, you know, you crest a hill and you look off into the distance, and there's a herd of 1,000 animals, you know, off in the horizon, and these beautiful mountains and just this, you know, vast empty valley. You know, every time you crest a hill, it looks like the cover of a National Geographic magazine. It's just incredible. And then, you know, maybe 2 days later, some guy will ride by with this giant eagle on his arm because he's an eagle hunter there. And it's an incredible place. I've never been anywhere like it. And getting back to, you know, the experience and the impact on people, and, you know, we're about a month removed from that experience now, and people are still integrating and sharing their thoughts. And, you know, maybe this would be best if I could just share. I'll see if I can find it. Maybe I can't. But one of the participants on the experience shared this beautiful reflection on it. It's interesting because it ties into connection, but from a very different angle, which is the idea of being alone. And it'll make sense once I reflect these words. I felt alone, but never lonely, a sense of empty and no thing in the vastness of it all. And yet so full of life, full of presence, full of awe, full of other humans and community, full of sun, sky, earth, mountains, snow, breath, air, the herd, beautiful food, freedom, music, play, dance, movement, adventure. And maybe most of all, wild. We were full of wild, empty of things and yet so full of everything that felt alive. We were people whose attention was both within ourselves and also on each other. We were in the moment and present to do what was in front of each of us, not on a text, a to-do list, not in the past nor in the future, just in the right now. And as Alan taught me, I am here now in this, alone and yet not. I looked up the etymology of the word alone, from Middle English, alone, with two L's. From earlier, all un, alone, literally all one, contracted from the Old English phrase eal an, equivalent to all one. Somehow we forgot, somehow the word lost its true meaning, all one, as the original meaning intended. We were completely all one, maybe we still are. And so there's this beautiful reflection of being in this vast landscape. And people were often, you know, on their own, particularly if they were part of the walking group, they would, I encourage people, you know, find some time to just go off and be by yourself and explore this landscape. And it's the most silent place I've ever been to on earth. We didn't run into a single other foreigner. We ran into maybe three or four other locals over the course of our 8 days there. We didn't see a single plane fly overhead. It was just the most silent place I've ever been. And when it's that silent, you can hear your own heartbeat. You can hear your own soul speaking to you if you stand still enough. And it was just this magical experience. She touched on that, you know, in a lot of places, like if I'm here in my house and I'm just alone by myself and I'm with my phone or trying to distract myself or something, it's not a very nourishing experience. But there it felt like I could be on my own for days and it would be an extremely nourishing experience. And then the theme for our event was transitions and transformations. And so it was amazing to have this beautiful backdrop of this migration. And these people have been doing this migration for thousands of years and, you know, in constant transition. And so it was a wonderful meditation on what it means to be human and what it means to be in transition, because we're always in transition, and what it means to be connected to Earth and connected to each other.
That's so beautiful, Mike. Thanks for sharing. And what a great essay. I could relate. As I rode across the country, across America, not arriving at places as remote as where you were in Mongolia, but sections of Montana and Wyoming where I didn't see a soul except maybe cattle. It was just me and no devices, not listening to anything. It was just the sound of my bicycle and maybe the sound of the wind, two very windy places in America, but never really felt lonely. Although I was by myself, I felt connected. So I love that you read that. That's beautiful. And it's amazing. The nomads know exactly where to go. So do the animals. There's no GPS. They just know within them when to go and where to go. And they sort of just follow their way, which is really cool.
Well, I'll tell you about that. The very first day, so we spent 3 days up at their fall camp. And then the fourth day was the first day of the migration. And I was part of the walking group that day. And the family had set their sheep loose, and the sheep just went ahead. And we caught up to them. We left about an hour and a half, 2 hours later. And we caught up to them, you know, maybe an hour, hour and a half after that. So halfway through the day. And they'd already covered probably, you know, 6 or 7 miles. And they were just kind of going on their own. And there was all sorts of ways that they could go. And they were just, and we actually didn't really know where we were going. And, you know, I had a radio and I could have asked my local people, but we just figured, hey, let's trust in the sheep. And it turns out the sheep knew exactly where they're going. And it was just a strange experience. This giant herd of sheep, they were just meandering their way to the next camp with, you know, they didn't have any GPS or anybody telling them where to go. They just knew. And they had this sort of inner GPS.
Yeah, I think we do as well. I think it might be a little atrophied, but I do think if we just got quiet more frequently, as humans, we know where to go to. But there's just so much. We live in such a noisy world that mixes up our signal and mixes up our connection with ourselves. So I love that. That's cool. Go for a win for the sheep. Follow the sheep.
Yeah.
A new mantra. So speaking of transitions and transformation, as we look to round out our conversation, the work that you're doing today with entrepreneurs, I think is really meaningful. So I want to give you some space to talk about it, because I think what's happened over the last, say, 10, 15 years, maybe 20, depending what time frame someone wants to grab onto, the whole hustle and grind culture has left us in this position today, where you have a lot of burnout and a lot of dissatisfaction, and there's a lot of comparison and less than or fixed mindset thinking, and people are working more and more just trying to grab someone's attention. It seems like there's a whole bunch of people just screaming out into the wind, wanting to be heard and seen and appreciated. So can you share a bit about your take on entrepreneurship as we go forward, because I think it's a really refreshing look at it and a much healthier look at it. So I want to give you some space to share.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I'll preface this by saying that I very much bought into that story. You know, with my last company, I brought on investors 3 different times. I hired lots of people. I had set crazy ambitious goals. You know, going back to 2016, I'd set a goal of I wanted the company to be operating in 150 countries by 2021. And, you know, those next 3 years, I sold the company in 2019. Those next 3 years were just, you know, all hustle and grind and like, you know, pushing myself, pushing my team. And there were a couple of events that changed, that kind of woke me up from that slumber, so to speak. One was Ryan Holiday's book, The Ego is the Enemy. And, you know, reading the pages of that book, I could see myself in that book. And the other was, I mentioned Philip McKernan. He's a wonderful coach. He also does retreats. He does them primarily in Ireland. He led a short 1-hour session at this entrepreneur conference I attended. And one of the questions he asked in that was, where are you seeking validation? And I started looking at my company, and it was sort of like a light bulb moment of like, all this striving and all these goals and all this endless hustle was just a quest for validation, and validation that I wasn't getting elsewhere or I didn't have internally, intrinsically, and that, you know, I wanted to be on the cover of Entrepreneur magazine, and I wanted to add more zeros so that people could tell me that I was valuable and that I meant something. And those two things, that book and that workshop, were the starting point of a very different journey that started with realizing I was never going to get the validation I needed from that. I could add, you know, 10 zeros to my company and it wouldn't change anything. I could be on the cover of Entrepreneur magazine and, you know, maybe I'd celebrate that for 10 minutes and hang it on my desk, but it wouldn't give me anything lasting. So I ended up selling that company, and I was already kind of on the side doing events with Wayfinders. And it really just came about because I wanted to create sort of an entrepreneur event or an entrepreneur conference where the focus was on connection rather than information and speakers and workshops and stuff like that. I set out with this company to approach it very differently. And I knew that revenue and profit weren't going to give me the validation I needed. I needed to get the company to the point where it earned me a nice living. But I wanted the focus to be both on myself, my skills and my passions and what I could bring to the world, but also the value that I could bring to other people. And I've maintained that commitment, you know, from the beginning of wanting to create really deep, profound value for other people. And that is, number one, innately more fulfilling than just chasing revenue goals. And number two, it's just a better business strategy, because when people sense that you are, you know, you're in it for their best interest, that you want to create value for them, that you want their lives to be better, they just gravitate to you. And so when I speak about what I do to other people, they can sense there's other ways I could make I'm a pretty smart guy. I could make piles of money if I wanted to go into the financial sector or whatever. I do this because I really love it. I love the people I get to work with. I love to make their lives better. And yesterday, you know, at dinner, when people were sharing their stories of transformation since the Mongolia event, it was just, you know, deeply touching to see that I've helped improve people's lives. And so, you know, that remains the North Star in terms of how I approach my business. It's aligned with who I am and my skills and my soul, if you will, and that it creates deep value for other people. And if I keep those two things in the forefront, then things tend to go well. You know, I've sold out all my events to the end of 2024. I'm almost half full for 2025 already. And that's because I'm not chasing these meaningless goals. And I've also resisted the idea, like I could scale the company, I could offer more events, I could do lots more things, but it's reached a level where it pays me a very nice living. I work with a small group of people that I love dearly. And, you know, going back to the revenue and the profit thing, I maintain my focus on a profitable business, not chasing revenue growth. And I really got into trouble with my last company, just like pushing revenue. And the thing I've discovered, you know, both myself personally and the people that I'm surrounded with, is when you put your foot on the gas hard on revenue, the expenses often outpace the revenue and you end up growing yourself out of business unless you're careful. And then I've also discovered, you know, how to implement systems and processes so that I don't have to work too hard. I have an assistant who handles almost everything that I don't like doing, and I focus on my zone of genius. So I'm wrapping this up into a 30-week business coaching program called the Entrepreneur's Compass. And it's the other part of what we were chatting about this before, is that it's community-based. And so everybody gets put into a cohort with four or five other people, and there's, you know, frequent connections with them. And then we have a biweekly coaching call, and it includes membership in the Wayfinders community. And so I'm trying to bring that sense of community and connection into the business coaching world, and I'm super excited about it.
I love that, Mike. What I hear is just what you discovered along the way is making sure that as you approach your business or businesses, it's connected to your first principles and who you are. And going back to that young kid who didn't feel like he belonged anywhere, you've been able to create communities where there's a sense of belonging because there's a like-heartedness of the humans in it, as opposed to some other metric. You mentioned revenue or followers or what have you. So I love that comfy spot of feeling like, okay, it's this, and I feel connected and feel a sense of purpose. The Japanese might call it ikigai, you know, a reason to get up in the morning.
Ikigai, yep.
I love that. So two questions and we'll wrap up. So this first question comes from a show that aired in the States. I'm not sure if it aired in Canada, called Inside the Actor Studio. James Lipton was the host, and he would interview actors. And he was famous for going through like a rapid fire round with the actor or actresses. And this one question I've pulled from his series of questions, and it goes like this. So assuming that heaven and God exist, when it's all said and done for you and you arrive at the pearly gates, what would you want God to say to you?
Pretty good question. You know, I pondered a lot, you know, now that I'm 52, about this idea of legacy. We actually had this conversation last night at our Mongolia reunion dinner. And it's very easy to get caught up in this idea of legacy, like I have to impact a million people and I have to, you know, create this company or charity and impact all these people. And that to me always feels like a little bit of an ego thing. And to me, it's just as simple as I want to leave every single person that I come in contact with enriched from our time being spent together. And I want to be enriched as well from those conversations. And that goes back to that topic of curiosity. And I think the simplest way I know to enrich another person's life, even if it's just a simple, you know, transaction or whatever, is to just be curious and to pay attention and to help them feel seen and heard. And so that's kind of my guiding principle in terms of my interactions with other people. And if I can keep that front and center, generally those relationships and those interactions are quite positive. And so, you know, if I were to be meeting God at the pearly gates, I would like him to say, you did a pretty good job of seeing and hearing other people and making them feel seen and heard. And so that would make me feel good.
That's really cool. Yeah, great answer, Mike. So when I do a loving kindness practice, three phrases I share in the loving kindness meditation practice is, may you feel heard, may you feel seen, may you feel loved. So for people to find you so they can hear more about you and they can see what you do in the world so they can love you or appreciate you more, where would you like to direct them to go?
Yeah, they can go to way-finders.com, way-finders.com.
Awesome. Well, Mike, thanks for rippling goodness into the world. You definitely embrace the spirit of Kintsugi and connection. And from my perspective, the world needs more of you because we're at a great moment here, this inflection point moment, I believe, where if we can connect with each other and connect with ourselves, we can put a more beautiful ripple into the world. So thanks for doing what you're doing.
Thank you. Right back at you.
So thanks for being on the show. And we'll catch up the next time I'm up in Toronto.
Awesome. At a Blue Jays game.
Absolutely. With a win.
Yes. Thanks, Michael.
I so appreciate Mike's energy, his wisdom, and how he referenced the importance of solitude, which has been key in my healing journey, in my Kintsugi, whether with my meditation practice or cycling across America. Having quiet has been essential in helping me connect with who I am and with others. I would love to know what you have taken away from Mike's story. You can drop me an email or go to the kintsugipodcast.com and leave a note there. And as you might know, we love to drop in to a short meditation based on this week's story. So we'll do just that, a simple 2-minute practice that invites us to be still. So if you're ready, settle in to a comfortable posture. You can close your eyes, or you may wish to keep them open. And we'll drop in. We'll take a few grounding inhales and slow releasing exhales, giving yourself permission to come into this moment, inviting stillness, a moment to simply be. And when it feels right, settle into the natural rhythm of the breath and gracefully place your attention on wherever you feel your breath. Allowing yourself to be in this moment, finding stillness, as you connect with this moment and your breath. Appreciating the gentle rise with each breath in and the release with each breath out. All right, nice job. When you feel ready, you can ease your attention and open the eyes and wiggle those beautiful fingers and toes. I would like to thank Mike again for giving of his time to join us and sharing his wisdom with us about the importance of connection. And I hope you'll do the same. Send Mike a note on your social media platform of choice and reach out and make a connection with him. Mike, thank you. We appreciate you. Also, I'd like to give a shout out to the like-hearted humans at SaaSPod that make the Kintsugi podcast sound so great and help it ripple into all corners of this big blue marble that we all share. And now, I want to thank you for listening and supporting the Kintsugi podcast. And if you want to go above and beyond in your support, I could certainly use a kind rating, a review, subscribing, or sharing, because it does something to the algorithm that I don't completely understand. But when you engage in this way, it helps others find our like-hearted community. If you've already done so, thank you for the extra support. And if you haven't done so yet, today might be a really good day to do so. And if you'd like to receive some additional resources that can help you connect with yourself and others, like my Better Life Workbook and the inspirational text messages I send throughout the week, and of course, our Pause, Breathe, Reflect meditation app, I'll put those links in our show notes. And remember, between now and next week's story of connection, when you have a challenging moment, slow down, come back to your breath. You know that you've got this and we've got you. And together, we will ripple something worth rippling into the world. I love you for listening, and I hope to see you next week. Until then, toodaloo.